The same still going on, all that bubbling, the trumpet, great trumpet solos in this. I'm a trumpet player. And then all those horns, aren't they wonderful? John Williams really loved horns, French horns. More tambourine. Then it gets a little faster. This is the massiveness, but the lightness of Jupiter. You hear the fatness of it and the lightness at the same time? It's amazing. Cellos and horns. That's how it was originally heard. Now notice it doesn't go down an octave. Goes out of the French horn range. But we add the trumpet. Hear it? So it can stay up high. Listen to the rest of it. It's got a fantastic ending. Anyway, I thought you'd get a kick out of hearing it if you hadn't heard it before. That was how it was originally written. So it's wonderful that we can take tunes from other composers, great composers like that, and turn them into hymns. But it's also wonderful that we can remember what they meant to the composer when he first wrote it. Another example of that, of course, is the Beethoven Ninth Symphony tune, the fourth movement. We sing, joyful, joyful, we adore thee, don't we? God of glory, Lord of love. I forget the words. That's right, I think. But, of course, Beethoven didn't write that as a Christian song either. It's Freude, Freude, Unsperrungen, Tochter aus Elysium. It's about the joy of the brotherhood of man. It's a Schiller poem. Deine Zauber binden wieder, was die Modestren geteilt, alle Menschen werden Brüder, wo dein sanfter Flügel war. So, all men are brothers where the wing of your, how would you translate it? Wing of your brotherhood flies through. Anyway, let me see if I can get us on to another great artist, T.S. Eliot. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was a great deal of optimism about the future of mankind. Let's see if I can hold on. Just give me one second here. I've got the wrong file up here. There it is. There was a lot of optimism at the beginning of the 20th century because we as a people kind of believed that God was out of the picture now. Really, we didn't have to rely on Him to give us our direction. We can go our own way, and in many ways accomplished a great deal on a kind of practical level, on a technological level. The very end of the 19th century, you find electricity, the telephone, the telegraph are being invented. The beginning of the 20th century, you have the automobile and the airplane and all sorts of inventions and things. Things are really going well in the first 10 or so years of the 20th century. But the philosophers and the artists were more concerned. They looked forward and they said things don't look good, partly because of what Friedrich Nietzsche taught about God having been erased. Really, we had created God, he said, as a people, and then we didn't need him anymore, so we got rid of him. But he also said, beware, because if you get rid of God, you're also going to lose meaning and morals. And he was right. And the 20th century, I think, is a good example of that prophecy. We had more deaths due to conflict in the 20th century than in all the 19 centuries before then put together. And what happened was, after the First World War, which was the sort of big climax of this and the end of this optimism that the general public held and began to think, oh, maybe they were right about things not going well. Hold on just another second here. Let me see if I can get this to play. Oh, I know. I have to move it to the other side, don't I? There we go. Right then. Where is play? I can't tell. Oh, there it is. Thanks. The angle is so funny. Okay. So, when was the First World War? What years? 14 to what? 18. Very good. That's right. So in 1922, when Eliot wrote The Wasteland, this was the first few years after the war. And Eliot and the others in France used to call this time, looking back on it, l'entre-deux-guerres, the time between two wars, between 1918 and 1939 in Europe. And that's the period that we're going to be talking about right now. And since I've spent so much time on Holst at the beginning, I'm not going to be able to talk about a lot of the history, but let's get into the poetry itself. Eliot became very famous in the world of poetry for a poem called The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. And it was 1919, I think, just after the war. But then he wrote this, and this became really in many people's minds, the greatest poem of the 20th century. It's a poem about fragmentation, which is what he was expressing the world was going to be going through. Fragmentation. We no longer have a center to our lives. We no longer have a center to our morals or to our meaning. And how do we make sense of life now? So what he did was he wrote a poem that on the surface seems almost schizophrenic. It switches gears all the time. It's constantly moving from one voice to another, from one author to another, as it were. I'll show you the very first of these segments that I'm going to give you. I'm going to read you the second. The Wasteland is in five parts. I'm going to read you this beginning of the first here, but then I'm going to spend most of my time on the second one, A Game of Chess, and we'll take it apart together, I hope, if we have time. So let me just read you this quickly and then show you something about it. This is the very beginning of The Wasteland. April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar keine Russen, stamm aus Litauen, auch Deutsch. Sorry about my accent. And we were children staying at the Archduke's, my cousins. He took me out on a sled, and I was frightened, and he said, Marie, hold on tight. Down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter. What the heck is he talking about? Well, first of all, let me just give you a quick analysis, okay? If I were looking at this for the first time, I would ask myself, where do I see breaks in it? Where does it change from one thought to another, from one sort of scene to another? And I think you can argue that there are two scenes here smashed together. One of them starts with April is the cruelest month and goes down to a little life with dried tubers. And then the next line is summer surprised us. It's a different place, a different time, it's a different voice. And that section goes from there to the bottom of the screen. So let's take the first part first. What does he mean, April is the cruelest month? Breeding lilacs out of the dead land. Why would breeding lilacs be a cruel thing to do? Very good. He says they're a reminder of what was. That's very good. There's evidence beyond that to support your theory. Look at this. Lilacs mix memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Then it says, winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow. In some ways, he's saying, in the wintertime, we were numb. We were asleep, like these tubers under the ground, kind of hibernating, you see. But now the spring comes and the spring rains and the warmth and so on, and it brings lilacs out of the ground, and it makes us have to remember how serious and how bad things are. And so that's what he's talking about. But he's also doing something else. What do you think of, just in general, when you hear something about April being a month? Does it ring any bells with you? Another work? Rain, did you say? Oh, I see. Right. Got it. Yeah, well, that's right. That's true. Say again. Chaucer. Bingo. Do you all know the beginning of the Canterbury Tales? Very good. Let me show you the very beginning of the Canterbury Tales. When April with his shower sweet with fruit, the draught of March had pierced unto the root and bathed each vein with liquor that has power to generate therein and sire the flower, dot, 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 there's more description, But the final conclusion is, at the bottom of it is, then do folk long to go on pilgrimage. Eliot was an extremely well-read man, better than most of his contemporaries and far better than me. And he intended for you to hear this in the opening reference. He intended you to hear Chaucer, but then he said April is the cruelest month. It's the month where these flowers start to come. They're bathed in each vein with liquor that has power to generate flowers. But it's not a happy time. It's just the opposite. When those flowers grow, we're forced to remember the things that we're missing. We're forced to remember the hardships, the difficulties, and so on. So this I give you just as one example, but you need to understand that the entire poem, The Wasteland, is full of allusions like that to everything in the history of Western and Eastern thought. It's absolutely an encyclopedia of quotes and references to all sorts of other works. Shakespeare, Ovid, Milton, Baudelaire. It goes on and on and on. Everybody, even the Buddha, he quotes Hindu scriptures. He quotes Buddhist scriptures. He just quotes everything. And look at this. This is why I tell you this is an important poem. Because, you know, the whole discussion I've been having with you is about form and content. And his point, his content to get across, is that the world is in fragments. The world is fragmented. Our lives are fragmented. We need some kind of unity to our lives, and we can't find it. So what does he do? Does he tell you the world is fragmented? No. He gives you stories. He gives you references I haven't shown you the last one. I'll go back to one. But all throughout the work, he is not only telling you that things are fragmented, but he's doing it by sewing together fragments from past works, you see? So the form of it is fragments of other works and references to other works like Chaucer. And the content of it is we're living in a fragmented world. So it's genius. It's brilliant. That's beauty. That's what I mean by beauty. Beauty is something where you take two different things, form and content, you bring them together, and together they are able to convey and express the idea of the author. Look at the second half of it for a second, though. Summer surprises coming over the Starnberger Sea. Starnberger Sea is a lake outside of Munich. With a shower of rain, we stopped in the colonnade. We went in the sunlight into the Hofgarten, drank coffee, talked for an hour. This doesn't sound like April is the cruelest month, does it? It's a different feel altogether. This is a story all in past tense. If you check the tenses, you see, we did this, we did that, we stopped here, we went there, we drank here, right? It's all in past tense. So this woman, you can tell eventually that it's a woman. It's Marie. You see her name down here. She's telling you a story about her childhood. And it's her childhood with the staying at the Archdukes, my cousins. Well, do you know who the Archduke was? Yes, exactly. And what happened to him? He was assassinated, and the result of his assassination was World War I. That's exactly right. And so here Eliot is calling on a diary of this woman, Marie, who was the cousin of the Archduke and spent summers with him and their family and so on and lived up the high life, basically, and went here and stopped there and drank coffee and talked. And she says, I'm not a Russian. I'm a Lithuanian. I'm a real German. I'm a real German. And not a Russian. And then she says, and when we were children, we stayed at the Archduke, and he took me out on a sled, and we went sledding. You see, hold on tight, Marie, he said, hold on tight. And down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. And that's where the past tense of the poem ends. Look at the last line. I read, present tense, much of the night and go south in the winter. Today, what I do in the wintertime is not sledding. Do you see? What if you were thrilled with your childhood in the wintertime in the mountains and sledding in the snow and so on, what would it be like to go south in the winter where it gets warmer? No more sledding. So what she's saying here is, this is how it used to be, and this is how it is now. So many of the aristocrats of Europe were dislodged, were lost their dukedoms and their countdoms and their places. After World War I. World War I just undermined an awful lot of the whole aristocratic lifestyle of the German and Austrian, Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so this is telling you, it's reminding you of a time in your childhood that was great fun, and it was associated with the pre-war aristocracy. And the last line is, today I read, basically he doesn't say today, but I read, the change of tense tells you, I read much of the night. And in the wintertime, when I could be going up and having a great time, I go south in the winter. It's another example of this fragmentation, this brokenness, this life that they now live. Okay, let me read you all of A Game of Chess. It's a little long, stick with me, but look while you go for that break in sections. Where do you think it changes? And I'm going to do my best to read it, I think, as he would have the characters actually read. The chair she sat in, like a burnished throne, glowed on the marble, where the glass, held up by standards wrought with fruited vines from which a golden Cupid had peeped out, another hid his eyes behind his wig, doubled the flames of seven-branched candelabra, reflecting light upon the table as the glitter of her jewels rose to meet it, from satin cases poured in rich profusion in vials of ivory and colored glass unstoppered, lurked her strange synthetic perfumes, unguent, powdered, or liquid, troubled, confused, and drowned the sense in odors. Stirred by the air that freshened from the window, these ascended in fattening the prolonged candle flames, flung their smoke into the laquearia, stirring the powdered ceiling. Huge seawood, fed with copper, burned green and orange, framed by the colored stone in which, sad light, a carved dolphin swam. Above the antique mantle was displayed, as though a window gave upon the sylvan scene, the change of Philomel by the barbarous king so rudely forced. Yet there the nightingale filled all the desert with inviolable voice, and still she cried, and still the world pursues, jug, jug to dirty ears. And other withered stumps of time were told upon the wall, staring forms leaned out, leading, hushing the room enclosed. Footsteps shuffled on a stair. Under the firelight, under the brush, her hair spread out in fiery points, glowed into words, then would be savagely still. My nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you're thinking. Think. I think we are in Rat's Alley where the dead men lost their bones. What is that noise? The wind under the door. What is that noise now? What's the wind doing? Nothing. Again, nothing. Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing? I remember those were pearls. Those are pearls that were his eyes. Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your head? But, oh, 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 that Shakespearean rag. It's so elegant, so intelligent. What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down so. What shall we do tomorrow? What shall we ever do? The hot water at 10, and if it rains, a closed car at 4. And we shall play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door. When Lil's husband got demobbed, I said, I didn't mince my words. I said to her myself, hurry up, please, it's time. Now, oh, but it's coming back. Make yourself a bit smart. He'll want to know what you've done with the money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. He did. I was there. You have them all out, Lil, he said. You have them all out. Get a nice set, he said. I swear I can't bear to look at you. And no more can I said. Think of poor Albert. He's been in the army for 4 years. It was a good time. And if you don't give it to him, there's others that will, I said. Oh, is there, she said. Oh, some of that, I said. Then I said, no, who to thank, she said, and gave me a straight look. Hurry up, please, it's time. If you don't like it, you can get on with it, I said. Others can pick and choose if you can't. But if Albert makes off, it won't be for lack of telling. You ought to be ashamed, I said. Look so antique, and her only 31. I can't help it, she said, pulling her long face. It's them pills I took. Bring it off, she said. She's had 5 already, and nearly died a young George. The chemist said it would be all right, but I've never been the same. You are a proper fool, I said. Well, if Albert won't leave you alone, there it is, I said. What'd you get married for if you don't want children? Hurry up, please, it's time. Well, that Sunday, Albert was home, and they had a hot gammon, and they asked me into dinner to get the beauty of it hot. Hurry up, please, it's time. Hurry up, please, it's time. Good night, Bill. Good night, Lou. Good night, May. Good night, ta-ta. Good night. Good night. Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night. And that's the end of the poem. Now, same question. What the heck is he talking about? The story goes that at one, I don't know what poem it was, it may very well have been this one, but it's something, where Eliot actually read his own poem in a recital, you know, and somebody came up to him afterward and said, Mr. Eliot, that's dense stuff, you know, what are you talking about? And I wish I could be as smart, as quick as he was. He said, do you want me to tell you worse? Do you want me to say it worse? Do you see what he's saying? I crafted every syllable of that. And that's the best way I know to say what it is I'm trying to say. That's the way to say it. If you ask me to summarize it, to bring it down into little sort of a bite-sized chunks, it won't have the same effect. So you need to be willing to let him tell you his story in his way. So, did you hear any breaks in it? Yeah? Okay, tell me where you heard one. Can you remember it enough to tell me? Yeah? Sorry? Okay. So can you pick? Oh, okay. Well, I think that's it's still a description of the things on the table there. Unstoppered vials, you know. Strange perfumes coming out of the vials. So it's still describing the room, I think. So that's not as good a division as maybe some of the others. Somebody else have one? Ah, okay. And the next bit, huh? By the way, the poem actually is written the way I have it here, too. So he put a space between glowed into words, then would be savagely still, space, my nerves are bad tonight. So that maybe would be a tip-off. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. What's the difference between the earlier part and this part? Yes, somebody's speaking now. We have quotation marks, don't we? The first was a description. The second one is quotations. Very good. Very good. Anything else? That's good. Is it the same people? Is it the same room?
Might
Might be the same room. I think so. Which this the quoted bit? Okay. Do you see how there are quotation marks around that? Do you see where there are no quotation marks? You see this line here? I think we are in Rat's Alley. What if this? I'm going to run out of time. What I love to do in class is actually unpack the whole thing with you, right, and just track with you and talk about each of the answers. I just don't have as much time as I'd like. Let me tell you this. It is the same place, only now we're hearing the people in it talking. One of them is speaking. My nerves are bad tonight. Speak. What are you saying? What are you thinking? I don't know what you're thinking. Think. And then you have this, I think we're in Rat's Alley. That's the response. But there are no quotation marks around it. So what do you suppose that means? Exactly. He's not saying it out loud. He's just thinking it. So here's a woman, very anxious, very upset. My nerves are bad tonight, she says. And she says to her, who, husband, I suppose, all these things, and he doesn't speak back to her. Do you see? This lack of communication between these two, this anxiety, this tension, this difficulty. But there's another section, and the next section starts here. And I tried to do the different voice for you so that you could hear. Because the first is a very upscale room, right? It's described in beautiful terms. Somebody's ornate bedroom with a beautiful dressing table and mirrors and fireplace and bottles of perfume and all sorts of wonderful smoke and coming from the candelabras, and it's very upper class stuff, right? I may go back and pick up a couple of things if I have time. But then this is quite different. This is lower class. And can you imagine why? Look at this. You see the difference between the texts? You have lowercase letters, and then you have a line in uppercase. Any of you been to English pubs before? Yeah? Have you ever heard, hurry up, please, it's time? At the end of the day, last call, it's time to go, we're trying to close, that's what you say. Hurry up, please, it's time. It's time to go. It's time to get on. So we're in a pub. We're in an English pub. And there's this woman, and we never do find out what her name is, but she's talking to her friends. She's talking to her friends about someone called Lil, short for Lily, probably. When Lil's husband got, do you know what demobbed means? Demobilized, when he got out of the army. When Lil's husband got out of the army, I said, I didn't mince my words. I said to her myself, now Albert, your husband, is coming back. Make yourself a bit smart. Fix yourself up a little bit. Make yourself a little pretty. He'll want to know what you've done with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. Do you know how old this woman is that has the teeth problems? 31. Good, you were paying attention. That's exactly right. She's only 31. You ought to be ashamed, I said, to look so antique, so old. And you only, and she's, and her only 30. Well, she's only 31 years old. She says, it's not my fault, she says. The next line is, I can't help it. She said, pulling a long face, it's them pills I took to bring it off, she said. What pills? She's had five already and nearly died of young George. She's had five what? Children. It's those pills to keep me from getting pregnant. It's that the chemist gave me these pills. The pharmacist gave me these pills. And I've had five children, and I nearly died from George, whichever in that line George was. Chemist, the pharmacist said it would be all right, but I've never been the same. Somehow the pills have messed her up, and they've made her teeth rot, at least, and make her look very antique, you see. So here she's saying to her friends, you are a proper fool, Lil, I told her. Well, if Albert won't leave you alone, there it is. Why'd you get married if you didn't want children, see? Don't fuss about having to have children. That's part of the deal. You got married, why not? But earlier, she says this. Let's see if I can go back one. Yeah. She says, think of poor Albert. He's been in the Army for 4 years. He wants a good time. And if you don't give him a good time, there's others that will, I said. Wah, wah, wah. Who? The woman talking, that's who. Look what she says. Others will. Oh, is there? She said. Oh, yeah? Something of that, I said. Yeah, something like that. That's right. Then she says, then I'll know who to thank, she said, and gave me a straight look. In other words, she's angling for Albert. See? Yeah, he's married to you. He's had a lot of kids with you, but I'll take him if you won't. I'll show him a good time if you don't. See what I mean? It's really a very dark and broken world these people are living in. This is broken marriages, fallenness, trying to manipulate and control childbearing, and then all of this intrigue, this woman who wants to sort of wheedle in, right? And look what happens at the very end of the story. She says, well, that Sunday, Albert was home. He came home. They had a hot gammon, which is a ham, I understand. And they asked me in to dinner to get the beauty of it hot. Dash. Wah, wah, wah. I think this is saying, I'm just going to kind of work my way in there, see, and see what happens. So here she is telling her friends this. And then finally the guy's saying, hurry up, please, it's time. Let's go. Come on, let's go. And so she says goodbye, good night to her friends. You see this? Good night, Bill. It's in colloquialism. Good night, Bill. Good night, Lou. Good night, mate. Good night. Good night. Ta-ta. Good night. Good night. Right like that. But look at the last two lines. That's not good night, ladies. It's good night, ladies. It's written out. You see? Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night. Now, do you all recognize that line? I haven't told you about any of the references in here. There are all sorts of references from Cleopatra, from Ovid, from Milton, from lots of different people. But this last, when I read this the first time, my hair stood up. Do you know where that's from? No. No. Shakespeare. Do you know? I'll give you a hint. Hamlet? Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night. Who says that? Ophelia. Do you know what happens to Ophelia in Hamlet? She loses her mind. She's nuts. Hamlet, who she loves, has dismissed her. Hamlet has killed her father, Polonius. And she snaps. She's gone. She has this mad scene. She comes on stage with flowers and she starts handing them out to everyone. Here's some for you. I used to have these flowers, but they're all in my father's grave now. I'm not kidding. That's not how she says it, but that's what she's talking about. And then she says, good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. And off she goes. And everybody else in the play weeps because she's the only person in the whole play that's innocent. And she's snapped. She's gone. And you know what she does after that? What happens to her after that? She drowns herself. She kills herself. The great scene at the end, you know, in Hamlet in the beginning of Act 5 is at the graveside, and he sees, you know, the skull, picks up the skull and says, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio. Do you know that, you know the scene? Well, that's Ophelia's grave. They're digging Ophelia's grave. It's the great, great tragedy of the thing. She is completely innocent. She only loved this man, and she got caught up in the machinery of all this political intrigue, and she paid the price for it. What is Eliot saying? Good night, ladies. Good night. Good night. Ta-ta. Good night. Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night. She's saying, we're living in Ophelia's madness. This is madness. And so this poem gives you two pictures. It gives you the picture of the extremely wealthy couple who are full of anxiety and full of meaninglessness and living out their lives in deadly disarray. And then it switches gears to the lower class pub, and you hear the same broken relationships going on there. This is a picture, this game of chess movement, I'm convinced, is a picture of the brokenness of love and relationships and marriages. And it doesn't make any difference how much money you have. They're all broken. Okay. Well, I only have a few minutes left. I could tell you more about the other passages. There's all sorts of, I could tell you another hour's worth about that one movement, and then there are four other movements. Let me do this, though. I want to take you through Eliot's life, because Eliot, when he was in 1922, he was not a Christian. But he was asking some very good questions. He was saying, what do we do with this brokenness? What do we do with this fragmentation of our world? We can't live here. This is madness. This is crazy. And he does a fantastic job, I think, of describing that madness and sort of elaborating the question, establishing the question. But later in that same decade, in 1927, he converted to Christianity. He became a believer. And he began writing poems that actually spoke more to Christianity as an answer to the poems in the wasteland. And he wrote many poems in that period after 1927. But the greatest of them, and I think the greatest poem of the 20th century, and I'm speaking as a musician here, so my poetry friends might want to straighten me out. But my favorite of the 20th century is a poem he wrote called The Four Quartets. Anybody ever read The Four Quartets? Wondrous, wondrous. Anybody else? Did I see another one? Superb. Well, I want to show you just a couple of snatches from the Four Quartets, because I think in the Four Quartets, he answers the questions that he raises in the wasteland. Look at this for a minute. This is, I should tell you the format. Eliot was fascinated with Beethoven's string quartets. Beethoven, toward the end of his life, wrote in his third period, late period, he wrote a lot of string quartets, and in some of them, he wrote them in five movements. If you know anything about sonata form, you know that it's always a four-movement form. But the string quartet had always historically been in four movements. But Beethoven was the one to break rules, and he created string quartets that had five movements. Well, I think Eliot kind of borrows on that, and he writes four what he calls quartets. But think of it as four poems. But each of the poems has five movements in accordance with Beethoven. This is the second movement, the fourth movement, rather, of the second quartet, the second poem. And see if you can tell what he's talking about right off the bat. This one's much shorter, and the rest of them will be very short. Just little excerpts. This is actually the whole fourth segment. I'll read the whole thing. The wounded surgeon plies the steel that questions the distempered part. Beneath the bleeding hands, we feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart. Our only health is the disease. If we obey the dying nurse whose constant care is not to please, but to remind of our and Adam's curse, and that to be restored, our sickness must grow worse. The whole earth is our hospital, endowed by the ruined millionaire, wherein, if we do dwell, we shall die of the absolute paternal care that will not leave us, but prevents us everywhere. The chill ascends from feet to knees. The fever sings in mental wires. If to be warmed, then I must freeze and quake in frigid purgatorial fires, of which the flame is roses and the smoke is briars. The dripping blood, our only drink, the bloody flesh, our only food, in spite of which we like to think that we are sound, substantial flesh and blood. Again, in spite of that, we call this Friday good. the wounded surgeon. Imagine a doctor who himself is wounded. Plies the steel that questions the distempered part, the diseased part in you. Beneath the bleeding hands, his hands are the ones that are bleeding. We feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart. Our only health is the disease. Do you remember Jesus saying, I didn't come to heal the well, I came to heal the sick. Our only health is the disease if we obey the dying nurse, if we accept that we are sinners. If we obey the dying nurse is Jesus, whose constant care is not to please us, but to remind of our and Adam's curse. That's what he's here to tell us about. You're under need. You're in need of being saved. You can't save yourself, you see. And that to be restored, our sickness must grow worse. We have to actually admit that we're fallen, and that we're nowhere near as good as we think we are. That's what he's talking about. The wounded surgeon is Jesus himself, who questions us and cuts out those parts that he wants gone. He who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion. That's what he's talking about here. Let me give you one more quickly that is about his own work. And I think it applies to all of your work, too. This is a little segment from the fifth movement of that second quartet, East Coker. And he's talking about his own work. He's a poet, right? So listen to this. So here I am in the middle way, having had 20 years largely wasted. The years of l'entre-deux-guerres. There's your between two wars. Trying to use words. That's what he does as a poet. Trying to use words. And every attempt is a wholly new start and a different kind of failure. Because one only has only learnt to get the better of words for the thing one no longer has to say. Or the way in which one is no longer disposed to say it. And so each venture is a new beginning, a raid on the inarticulate with shabby equipment, always deteriorating in the general mess of imprecision of feeling. Undisciplined squads of emotion. And what there is to conquer by strength and submission has already been discovered once or twice or several times by men whom one cannot hope to emulate. But there is no competition. There is only the fight to recover what has been lost and found and lost again and again, and now under conditions that seem unpropitious. But perhaps neither gain nor loss. For us, there is only the trying. The rest is not our business. Can you hear that? Here I am, having wasted 20 years, basically, trying to get the better of words. And I can't do it. I'm failing all the time, and I'm constantly using shabby equipment, my vocabulary, always deteriorating in the general mess of imprecision of feeling. I can't control the words. I can't figure out the ways to say the things I want to say. It's all very frustrating. But then he says, and everything that you wanted to say anyway has been said by somebody else better than you already. So why bother, right? Ah, now we get to the Christian part of it. He says, no competition. You're not in competition, you writers, with Shakespeare. Isn't that good? Isn't that great to know that you're not in competition? The point is not to beat Shakespeare. Or Milton, or Dante, or any of these great writers. The point is, he says, there is only the fight to recover what has been lost. And ladies and gentlemen, you are living in a world that has lost its way. And you can put to words those things to recover those things that were lost. And and so can I. So there's only the fight to recover what has been lost and found and lost again and again. Every generation has to find a way to speak the truth of the gospel, the application of the gospel to the watching world. If without us being salt and light in this world, there is no salt and light. And it's been lost and lost and lost again, over and over again. Every generation has to deal with it. And now we have to deal with it in conditions that seem unpropitious. I mean, it's in the middle of a war. He wrote this during the Second World War. But perhaps there's neither gain nor loss. Maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way. He says, for us, there's only obedience. That's what we can do. And leave the rest to Him. That's what you're supposed to be. You see? You don't have to beat everybody else out. You don't have to compare yourself to Shakespeare. You just have to speak the truth in love in your generation and leave the results to God. What a relief, huh? What a relief. It's His work that's going on here, not yours. But He lets you be a part. Isn't that incredible? He lets us play a role. And I think that's what Eliot is talking about here. Okay, I'm going to have to wrap up, I guess. I could show you several more, but I'll call it off. That's a little glimpse of what Eliot has been doing or did in the 20th century, before he became a Christian and after. And I think it's clear that if you go back and look through the four quartets, you'll find that there's much, much more there than I was even being given you in the parts that I did read you. And there's four-fifths of it that I haven't read you, so... it's quite a piece. So thank you for your patience, especially after lunch. And I'll see you again tonight.